You are listening to the podcast That's Life in Sweden, or as we say in Swedish, Sånt är livet i Sverige, with me, your host, Lisa Orsimäki. Via the mobile, I welcome Professor Pasi Sahlberg, a former Director General of Finland's Ministry of Education and Culture, today living and working at Melbourne University in Australia as a Professor of Educational Leadership. Welcome to the program, and how are you, Pasi?
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm fine. We are heading towards the holiday season here in Melbourne, Australia, so it's all good. Thank you for having me with you.
Wonderful. You presented a talk on choosing the right path for the next education reform at a Nobel Prize dialogue in Seoul, South Korea, in September this year, and where you talked about a paradigm shift in education. Can you explain what you meant?
Yes, it was a longer talk, so we don't probably have all the luxury of, you know, having all the time. But I try to do it briefly. My first argument is that we have had, probably during the last 20 or 25 years, a certain paradigm, education reform paradigm, globally, that sometimes is called global educational reform movement, that is based on assumptions that competition between schools and standardizing teaching and learning and measuring these outcomes and then holding teachers and schools and principals accountable for these measured outcomes would be the best way to improve both outcomes, learning outcomes, and efficiency of education. This is often also known as a market-based paradigm, because it looks very much like a marketplace, how the marketplace operates. So my first argument is that this has been the dominant paradigm around the world, really, in efforts to try to improve the whole education systems. And now when we have really come through, or hopefully come through the global pandemic, this paradigm has really been put in the test around the world, and as we have seen in the most recent OECD's PISA results, we see that these old paradigms, this included, is not necessarily anymore the one that will carry through our education systems to the world. That is very different than it used to be. So that's why I argue, my second argument is that we need a new, different paradigm that is much more based on humanistic values of individuals, valuing children's differences and diversities, and also understanding that the outcomes of education are much broader and much more than just the narrow band of literacy and numeracy that is often included in these assessments, not only in PISA, but in national assessments. So we need to see children more holistically, as a whole children carrying many more qualities than just the academic ones, and also seeing schools as holistic organizations and institutions where teaching and learning are focusing on much wider area of development than just learning, including well-being, and, you know, really understanding what's happening in the world. So this is, in brief, the essence of my argument that I spoke about in this convention in Seoul, and I think that this is really the paradigm that is emerging now around the world, certainly here in Australia and in Europe and North America, now that we have more evidence and data about how our school systems are doing.
So, Pasi, are you suggesting then that we should go do away with international assessment tests such as PISA?
I'm probably with many others who think that PISA is has become a too central theme in improving education, but certainly in the places where the education policies and future of school education is seen primarily through the improved test scores and improved rankings in PISA. I think we don't really need that type of global metrics right now. But I'm not saying that we need to do away completely the international comparisons and data that would help us to see how our own education systems are going. I'm probably would like to see much less emphasis on running education systems through global metrics and measurements. And certainly, I don't think that there's room for global competitions where education systems would be compared using very few academic subjects. I think education is much more complex thing. So in brief, I think we need to have internationally comparable data, whether it's research or statistics or surveys that we are doing now or something else, because otherwise, if we don't, I think the situation might be that we are trying to improve education systems just by beliefs and assumptions of something that is not based on evidence. So one part of me is saying that we have probably seen enough of these international rankings and the data that is not alone able to transform education systems, but at the other hand, we need to have some type of monitoring and measurement information that will help us to understand where we're going.
Now you're obviously a staunch supporter of fairness and equity in education, regardless of country, and I think that's coming across very clearly. I'm thinking back when we spoke last time in June 22, and that was the time when the Albanese Labour government replaced the Morrison Liberal government in Australia. And there were three things you hope for the Labour government, the incoming Labour government, to do, such as keep past promises, end the growing inequalities in schooling, and a better understanding of the teaching profession. So far, what do you think? Has the government kind of met your expectations, or?
Yeah, I think these are really, really big questions, and I understand that it's a big ask to keep when it comes to Australian education. Well, one thing that people need to understand, first of all, those who are not familiar with the Australian situation, is that we have a federal system. There are eight different states and territories, and education is the responsibility of them, not the federal government. So the current Commonwealth government or federal government that we have here has not direct involvement in what the schools and teachers and principals are doing in the community. So we need to be careful with that one. I think what has happened here during the last 18 months since we spoke last time is that there has definitely been intentional rebuilding of the narrative of schooling, that the role of teachers and educators is much more valued and respected by the politicians, the Commonwealth politicians here. I think there's also much better understanding of the nature of educational inequalities in this country and how much they are working. These inequalities are working against other efforts to try to improve education. I also think that there has been a change in the way the public and the politicians, certainly the Commonwealth politicians, talk about education here compared to what it used to be for a long time here. That narrative was very much about how much Australia is lagging behind the other countries and how bad the education actually in this country is, and the reason for that was often the bad or poor teachers or poor quality of teaching in the schools. I think the currently we have been seeing during the last 18 months a change of direction and a kind of a tone of this narrative where, for example, the Commonwealth Minister is frequently saying that we have good education system, but it can be much better and much fairer than it is now. So as you know, is that the education systems change and improve very slowly, though. So in an educational environment like Australia, in a federal system, it would be a miracle to be able to see some significant changes and improvements in the outcomes in 18 months. But, you know, all of these things that I mentioned that I have seen and many others have witnessed here since June 2022, I think are worth mentioning and celebrating as well, because they are all changes towards kind of a right direction. And if we only had a political situation here after the elections, as you know, that the election political term here, the Commonwealth is 3 years, which is very short. So if we can continue 3 more years, I think we would probably also be able to see some of the concrete outcomes and results that were promised a year and a half ago.
Last time we also spoke about the different reforms in Australia that has been done for years and years, and really nothing substantial has really come out of any of the reforms. So I'm curious, because I hear the issue of equity is really important, not only for Australian educational system, but also for us here in the Nordic countries, and especially Sweden. So what are your thoughts about the Australian National School Reform Agreement?
Well, these National School Reform Agreements, for those who are not familiar with the concept, they are bilateral agreements between the Commonwealth federal government and the state and territory government. So there are 8 of those agreements. And as you said, the equity will be one of the key areas of negotiations and specifications in these next agreements that will be negotiated next year. So equity actually has been part of these current agreements that will be expiring now in a couple of weeks, time, or they're actually going to continue next, extended to next year as well. But, you know, the problem, a challenge here is, and it's a similar challenge in Sweden and Finland and Nordic countries, is that we are still not very clear what we mean by equity in education. Just to give you an example, that often in these conversations, and it may be that it has been part of this National School Reform Agreement negotiations as well earlier, is that the equity in education is sometimes seen as similar to equality of opportunity to good education. And you and I, we do know that the equity is much, much more complicated than just providing equal opportunity for all the children to have good education. Like here in Australia, for example, and in Sweden, where there's a significant amount of private education available, some people argue that because of this range of different types of schools, independent schools and many others, that parents can kind of choose for their children the best education that they think the kids need. And this, of course, is not what equity of education outcomes means. And so that's why the critical issue here in this National School Reform Agreement talks that will take place next year is to agree and define what equity in education means. That it should mean that we are trying to close the achievement gaps between the most affluent or the richest part of the the student population and then the most disadvantaged students. That is one important aspect of equity. We often in our work here we have called that a social equity, but then there's another one, the other dimension of equity that should be part of this definition and these negotiations is the attainment or how many students are successfully completing secondary school and how many students are reaching the proficiency levels in different curriculum areas. But, you know, as I said earlier, that we still, it's not still certain that we are going to see a unified or common understanding of what equity in education means. If we don't, then of course it means that we are going to see different definitions and different targets and different ways of measuring and different kind of levels of progress that will be made in trying to make Australian education more equitable. So that's something that remains to be seen next year.
Mm-hmm. Now, you wrote a position paper for the Australian Government Primary Principals Association, and it was titled A Better and Fairer Start for All. Relating to your call to end the growing inequalities in Australian schooling, what sort of response have you received? And do you think funding is the issue?
The funding is definitely one important aspect of fixing these problems and challenges that we have in Australian schooling. And again, for those who are not familiar with all the details when it comes to the economics of education here, we have this peculiar situation where the governments, meaning the state and territory governments and federal government, are funding all schools, including private schools. That is not often the case in other countries. And during the last 10 years, the strange phenomenon has been that the funding, government funding for private schools has grown much faster than for public schools. And that has led our schools in a situation where practically all public schools are underfunded. We are using the common standard for school funding, what the schools should be receiving funding so that they can do what they are supposed to do. And practically all the private schools or non-government schools are already funded to the standards. And at the same time, we have more than 80% of our most disadvantaged students, and including our First Nations children, are attending these public schools that are underfunded. So that is the kind of a situation where we are that is often very difficult for outsiders, non-Australians, to understand that why do we fund our schools like this? But even if you don't understand exactly why the funding looks like this, it's probably easy to understand that it's very difficult to have equitable and high-performing education system or systems of schools here if the funding, this funding gap for the disadvantaged public schools continues to be an issue. So that's why the funding is a big part of the solution. And I think we need to reach the situation where all these public schools, especially the ones that are having significant number of most disadvantaged students, those who have special needs, as we describe in this Australian Government Primary Principles paper that you mentioned. But at the same time, I think it's also important to keep in mind that funding alone is not going to solve the problem. So it depends on what that extra money for these underfunded public schools will do, how is it spent, and whether these schools will be eventually able to make a difference in the students and children's lives that they are serving when they have these new extra resources there. So funding is the condition, but it's not going to be the automatic solution to the problem.
And so what role does teachers play in the education of kids?
Well, teachers obviously are the most important in school factor explaining the students' learning and achievement in the school. So teachers can make many things happen that would not be possible without them. And that's why I think here in Australia we need to double our efforts to make sure that we have enough young people interested in becoming teachers, because the situation is a little bit similar to what it is in Sweden and some other countries, that there are less and less young Australians who see teaching as a potential or interesting life career for themselves. And that has led to a situation where many Australian schools are either short of teachers altogether, or then there are people teaching, for example, mathematics. That is a big area of shortage. Teachers who are not prepared to teach mathematics, and that's why, of course, your question about the role of teachers is becoming in the new light, because we may have a teacher in a classroom, but this teacher may be somebody who is not prepared to do or teach in a way that makes a big difference. So that's why I think we need to really think harder about the role of teachers and the role of the teaching profession, but never forget that teachers would be able to overcome all those disadvantages that may be present in the communities or lives of many children, because the home background and parents and the community still continues to be the biggest factor that explains what children learn in a school or what they don't learn. And that's why teachers are just part of this puzzle that includes also all those important out-of-school factors like family, parents, and what's happening in the community.
Mm. To another question, Australia has a framework for generative artificial intelligence in schools. Now, apart from challenges such as sourcing expertise, money, and collaborative learning, there is a concern that needs to be considered, which is that AI has the potential to reproduce existing inequalities in Australian education.
Yeah, it's a really big question. Nobody really knows how this will play out when it comes to technology, and certainly with the artificial intelligence. But I think that, you know, one of the interesting aspects of this potential inequalities is that we have had the ChatGPT and similar tools with us now just barely a year. And it often is in the beginning when the technological solutions become available, is that they are free in the beginning, but then at some point, people need to begin to pay for that. We already see that the ChatGPT 3.5 is accessible for everyone, but the more advanced versions of that same solution, you have to pay for that. And whenever something like this happens, and it can be, it's the same thing with any other software or solution or program, that some schools, for example, or some parents may be able to afford to have those more advanced and better performing technological solutions for this for their students or children, and some don't. And this is where we can see the potential inequity or inequalities arising as the technology progresses further. But then the other one is, of course, what our children have at home. And again it's needless to say that some of our students and children have, that they live in homes where they are more technologies, not only hardware available, but also people, parents, adults who are able to work with their children and students, you know, explaining what you can do with the ChatGPT, for example, and where the risks and dangers may kind of a wait for these kids. And if you don't have that adult supervision or expertise available at home, then of course it puts you in a very different situation that compared to your classmates who may have that adult support available there. Then of course the final thing that I want to add here is the you know, all these limits and restrictions that young people often need in order to live safe and responsible and healthy life with their gadgets and devices is something that families are very differently equipped to provide to their kids. And as soon as we begin to see schools banning technology in a school, whether it's about the artificial intelligence or just the basic smartphones, then the question arises that who is going to teach and help these children to learn to live and use these devices safely and responsibly if that is not the school. So there are a lot of questions that we don't know. There are some issues that we do see. And interestingly, the latest PISA results already revealed some of the inconvenient outcomes of the heavy and frequent use of the technological gadgets and devices of young people, if the control is missing or if the adult supervision and help and support is not there.
Mm. And that is, of course, a new challenge for many teachers. Yeah, and how are they going to actually negotiate that journey with the kids in schools? And that comes back to, you know, whether if you go to a private school, well, they got all the resources there for having the latest gadgets, whereas in a public school, they may not have it. And it's not only about the school, it's also about the community, you know, how wealthy the community is. How would you explain, and what are your thoughts about education for sustainable development and the 17 sustainability goals?
Yeah, it's a very, very much related question to technology. And I think that what we have seen is, you know, Nordic countries are good examples of the youth leadership in some of the sustainable development and climate change issues. And you know, there, I know Finland very well and other Nordic countries as well, that there we kind of see differently the young people's leadership role in campaigning for the sustainable development or saving the planet, if you wish, compared to, you know, what it has been recently here in Australia, where the authorities and adult mindsets seem to be much more advising, you know, denying young people to do that and advising them to go back to school and learn in a classroom. We have even heard this language here recently that children's, young people's, teenagers' places, not in the streets, to show what they think about the world of peace or climate change, but study in a classroom and, you know, do those things when they are adults. And I think that, you know, this whole sustainable development thing is something that is much more relevant for young people, just like the technology that it is for many of the adults. And we should, whether you're politician or parent or teacher, always try to see these important global and future related issues from young people's point of view. And that's where I think the Nordic countries are ahead of many others in understanding that it's more about the student agency and their world that we are talking about, rather than just today's issues or, you know, what they should be doing with their lives now, whether it's about the school or something else.
In the last time we spoke, you also spoke really beautifully about the purpose of of schooling. If I'm going to pose that question again, can you explain what is the purpose of schooling for you?
That's a good addition. That is always, I think when we have these conversations, is that what is the purpose of schooling or education for you? Because people see this thing in a very different way. So I can't recall exactly what our conversation, Lisa, was last time, but I think that, you know, I haven't changed my mind much regarding this question, because for me, the purpose of schooling continues to be something that is seeing each and every child an individual that has different expectations and different interests and different views about themselves and the world. But at the heart of the purpose of education for me is the kind of a way to help each and every individual student to see where their own strength or where their own interest or passion is, and then support these individual students to carry on, you know, digging deeper and broader in their own passion and try to learn more about themselves and the world around them while they are doing so. So for me, you know, the idea of lifelong learning has been there for at least the last 30 years. We have heard about the importance of lifelong learning that is in a way behind this global development goals as well, because we cannot see much better future unless we put this lifelong learning goal in the agenda of each and every individual learner. And that's why, you know, if the young people would leave the school with this true interest and will and ability to learn continuously throughout their lives, I think that is probably the most sustainable way of also expecting that the future will be different and better than it would be without this type of kind of ideal of becoming a lifelong learner through schooling, but in the areas that are truly either within or close to each and every student's own passion and interest.
That is pretty close to what you actually said, and you used very few words last time. You actually said that it is about helping young people find their passion and interest, full stop.
Yeah, that's it is. Sounds good.
In a nutshell.
Yeah.
But yes. Yeah. But you also have written a discussion paper titled Reinventing Australian Schools together with several Australian academics that outlines five principles. And what I'm interested is that when we talk about principles and we come from different cultures, and how do we actually come together and agree on principles? I just want to mention what they are, and if you can just briefly talk about which one you consider the most important. I think they all are, but if there is one that comes to your mind. The first one was a whole child and whole school approach as an organizing principle. Co-designed, evidence-based and flexible learning and well-being approaches, and health and well-being as essential 21st century skills, building an engaging culture of health and well-being and learning in school, and relationships and partnership between services, families and schools in every community.
Yeah, it's a good set. Actually, when we were working on this this discussion, what we call a discussion paper, that there were many, many more than just those five. So it's very difficult to kind of pick up any one of them. But let me mention two of them that are,
sure,
are probably my kind of favorite things. And we have this seeing a whole child, adopting a kind of a whole child and whole school approach. We call that a kind of an organizing principle that cuts across all these other things. And this is a this goes back to what we spoke earlier about the importance of whole child development in the school rather than just, you know, measuring some of the academic things. So understanding what the whole child approach and development means is something that brings immediately health, well-being, and education much closer to one another than it used to be, and it kind of avoids this kind of a fragmented thinking that health and well-being are somebody else's responsibilities, and then schools are just teaching children knowledge and skills. So that's why I kind of want to underline this importance of understanding this organizing principle in our discussion paper that is called Whole Child and Whole School Approach as well, that are kind of linked together. But then the other one is that it has been a little bit of a kind of a newcomer in this conversation, and it is this seeing health as an essential 21st century skill. And I like that notion a lot because it sort of elevates health away from what it's often seen in the school, that it's in a school context, the health is often seen either information about health, that we are teaching children what it is to be health and how to live a healthy life and so on. Or it's seen in a school as a service to those young people who are at risk or have already lost part of their health. In other words, it's a service to try to help kids to recover and get back to this kind of a healthy situation. But what we mean by here, when we say that health is a 21st century skill, it means that it's something that schools could actively and proactively teach all young children as a skill, as something that the children could learn more about how to live a healthy life and how to take care of themselves and how to understand the importance of healthy meals or healthy way of living, the importance of active play and moving outside. So that's why I think, you know, this whole child and health as a 21st century skills, they're both calling for a different mindset, a different way of seeing the role of the school and also the who the young people are and what they should be able to do in order to live happy, healthy and good life after schooling.
It's really been interesting how you negotiate the Australian culture and just fascinating listening to you. Coming to the end, is there anything you want to take up that I haven't mentioned that is of particular importance? I know you've been really, really busy, but is there something really, something that has come up that you think is really of importance to share?
Yeah, no, I think it's just been a good conversation again, Lisa. The only thing that I think I would love to see a little bit more here in Australia, and it's probably, again, this is something that has already happened in the Nordic countries, in Sweden and Finland, and it is the active role and engagement of our teachers in trying to figure out what to do next. And I'm saying this because here it's still a very kind of like the most common way to see the role of teachers in this co-design process of future schools and future of education, is that teachers still are seen kind of a passive recipients, yes, of policies and reforms and ideas, and their main role is only in implementation of these new ideas that often come from above. And we do know in Nordic countries that we have, in good and bad, that we have been working very differently, trying to see teachers up as active partners and stakeholders in not only in implementation, but also thinking about what is the direction of change. So this is something that I would love to see here. And then the next step, kind of a next generation expectation that I have, is to extend this same idea to our young people and children. I do think here in Australia that I have recently been writing about in different occasions is that the young people here, and certainly in Sweden and other Nordic countries, that young people have much more capacities and capabilities to do good things for themselves and others than we give them credit for. Mm. That we have 4 million children here in Australia in our schools, and we are actually utilizing only very few of them in, for example, having them partners in thinking about the future or co-designing the directions for our education systems. And that's why I would love to see, next time when we talk, I would love to be able to tell you that we have made progress in you know, this way, understanding that, you know, children, young people can be partners in making change. They are change makers by nature. Mm-hmm. And we just need to find ways how to give them space and license to be partners with us and then work together, just like we have been working with them in the climate change and peace and many other things for the better schooling and better education systems. But that's the only thing that I would like to add here, to always keep in mind this thing that teachers have expertise and wisdom to tell us what to do and what not to do, and so do our young people, and we should invite them as partners in this journey.
Sounds fantastic. What's next for you? You are now stepping back from work and enjoying Christmas with the family down the beach.
Yeah, I'll try to do a little bit of that and also take a little bit of time for myself and read books that I have piled on my bedside table and library here that I have not been able to read much this year, and just recharged and enjoy the beautiful nature of the southern Australia here.
I wish you a wonderful, wonderful Christmas and a happy new year. Thank you so much, Pasi, for being on the program and sharing so generously your thoughts about challenges in education in Australia.
Thank you, Lisa, so much. And if you can, just please send me a little bit of snow for Christmas, because I miss those white dark Christmases and candles and everything that comes with it. So it's going to be Christmas on the beach here anyway.
Well, guess what? I'm in Göteborg and it is pouring down with rain. Don't talk to me about a white Christmas.
Okay. Thank you so much again for having me.
And you have been listening to the podcast Sånt är livet i Sverige, or in English, That's Life Here in Sweden, with me, Lisa Orsimäki. Till next time, take care of yourself and each other. Bye for now.